Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Fill her up.
You're listening to the Gas Digital Network.
Hey guys, today's show is brought to you by the Soho Forum, the wonderful debate series run by the great Gene Epstein. And of course, Gene will be debating our guest for today's show, Ben Burgess. The resolution: socialism is preferable to capitalism as an economic system that promotes freedom, equality, and prosperity. This debate will be live in the Villages, Florida. If you're in the area, go check it out. It's going to be a great time. Of course, they did a debate similar to this on the podcast a couple years ago, and I can't wait to watch this one. So go to thesohoforum.org for all of the information. Make sure you go support Gene Epstein and the Soho Forum, and he'll be debating our guest today. Ben Burgess should be a good one. All right, let's start the show.
We need to roll back the state. We spy on all of our own citizens.
Our prisons are flooded with nonviolent drug offenders.
If you want to know who America's next enemy is, look at who we're funding right now.
Every single one of these problems are a result of government being way too big.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to a brand new episode of Part of the Problem. I'm very happy to be joined today by a returning guest to the show, Ben Burgess. If you're not familiar with Ben, he's been on the podcast a couple times before. He's a professor of philosophy. He's an author and the host of the show Give Them an Argument. That was the title of his first book, but we're here to discuss his second book, which he just sent me and I was able to read. It's called Canceling Comedians While the World Burns. It's a critique of the contemporary left from the left, and I'm really excited to talk to you about this book. I just want to say I loved it. I didn't like it. I loved it. I thought it was incredible. And you really, you know, it's funny because obviously we have different perspectives on this issue. I'm a free market libertarian. You're a democratic socialist. But so many of your critiques of the left really resonated with me. So thank you for taking the time to come talk with us. I'm excited to get into it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man.
Oh, I should also mention, just to give a plug out, that you will be debating Gene Epstein at the Soho Forum coming up soon. Go to thesohoforum.org for all of that information. Of course, you guys did a debate that I moderated on the podcast. Mm-hmm. This will be a more formal Oxford-style debate with probably a much more competent moderator, if I had to guess.
You know, you did fine. You know, you did a good job of suppressing your secret socialist sympathies, you know, during the debate.
I've been practicing for years, you know, so it was fair easy enough for me. This is what I've been working on. So, the book is a critique of the left from the left, which I think is just it's one of the hardest things to do. It's one of the things that takes a lot more courage, if you ask me, because it's easy to go out there and critique the right if you're a lefty, and it's easy to critique the left if you're a right-wing person. You're not going to piss off your own base. You're not going to get the same type of heat. You are the champion of your little, you know, tribe.
Yeah, right.
But it's also, in many ways, a lot more useful and a lot more important to critique your own side, because this is where the most powerful, you know, adjustments can come from. And I've said for a long time, from even from the libertarian perspective, we want to have a better left wing in this country. I mean, if you really care about ending wars and ending mass incarceration, ending corporate bailouts and corporate welfare, like a lot of libertarians do, well, we're probably never going to accomplish any of those things without the left. Like, we're going to need a left wing on board with us. So I actually think it's in everybody's interest for the right wing to be better, for the left wing to be better, for libertarians to be better. So I really appreciate you writing this book. Let me just, if you could just tell people who haven't read it, maybe just give them a quick kind of breakdown of what the book is about and why you were inspired to write it.
Yeah, sure. So the book is about basically all of the ways that I think that the left is screwing up right now, that it's doing things and presenting itself in a way that make it harder to appeal to the great mass of people that we need to appeal to in order to actually achieve you know, any of our goals, either the ones that you just rattled off or the ones you disagree with, you know, either of them. And I think in particular, it's about the ways that that a lot of the contemporary left has really substituted for what it's supposed to be about, what it says it's about, right? Which is, you know, this critique of structures and institutions, what's in practice a kind of moralistic focus on individuals and, you know, and going after, you know, people for, you know, for their failure to, you know, exhibit, you know, sufficient levels of commitment, you know, to those goals. And I try to both like go into like a bunch of the ways that plays out. And then also to think a little bit about like why that is, you know, how we got to be this way.
Right. Yeah. So it's really, I've been talking about this a lot on my show and how you see this dynamic where for lack of a better term, what's called wokeism, you know, the woke stuff, which leads in a lot of different directions where it's, you can kind of conveniently hit who you want to, when you want to. And I've just been trying to point out to the left that you see like these huge corporations jumping on board with the woke stuff. And then it does very conveniently seem to be like, you know, Bernie Sanders gets criticized for being sexist and his supporters are sexist, or Glenn Greenwald is criticized for being sexist, or like all of these other, you know, and you just look at it, you're like, whether or not this is a plot, which I'm kind of convinced it is, but whether or not it is, in practice, the way it's working is that now you have these giant corporate interests almost getting off the hook as they are now able to attack any good leftist who's standing up for a left-wing cause for violating one of the woke rules or, you know, whatever it may be. Even like in the examples of Bernie Sanders, where it was unclear that he even did anything, even if he said what Elizabeth Warren had claimed he said, it wasn't clear that the spirit of it was anything sexist. But so it just seems like, you know, I see these things like JP Morgan Chase sending their execs to diversity training, and they have a float in the gay pride parade and all of these things. And I wonder if like, how is it not more obvious to the average left winger, however you feel about diversity training or gay pride or any of these issues, you could agree with them on all of it, but don't you see that they're fooling you? Like they're buying you off to say, oh yeah, we don't have to, you know, you don't have to focus on what a good left winger really should be focused on about JP Morgan Chase, which isn't whether their execs go to diversity training. It's the power imbalance, which is what you would think like a guy like you would want to focus on about them.
Yeah, no, for sure. So I think that there are a couple things, you know, going on there. I mean, when you talk about the diversity trainings, like, you know, oftentimes the ways that like a good criticism of that is going to get caricatured is, oh, you're saying that like, you know, racism isn't a big deal, that we should just like ignore racism and, you know, and focus on other things. But what I'd point out about that is that the effect of the Robin DiAngelo stuff is to change the subject from, you know, any sort of issue about the distribution of wealth or power, you know, between white people and black people in the United States, and to make it entirely about white people having sort of these weird corporate vision quests about their own, you know, internal attitudes, you know, which don't actually benefit anybody really, right? You know, like they might, I mean, I guess in theory they might make that one person less of an asshole, although I think that the empirical evidence for that is really lacking, but you know, but it's certainly not going to change any of the problems that lead to you having these massive divergences in you know, incarceration rates and poverty and healthcare and education and all of these things, you know, between white people and black people in the United States. And I think that when you talk about, like, you know, Bernie, you know, supporters or Bernie himself, you know, in the Elizabeth Warren case, where, you know, I do tend to think that, you know, that he didn't say that, but, you know, who knows? We'll never know. Those accusations of sexism, you know, to the extent that those are things that just come from like centrist liberals, you know, supporters of other candidates, then I think, okay, well, obviously it bothers me. It's cynical, you know, it's annoying. But, you know, that's in a sense sort of to be expected. What really bothered me during the election were cases where people who were on what I'd see as the right side were playing along with some of that stuff. So just as one obvious example that I talk about a little bit in the book, when Joe Rogan kind of sort of endorsed Bernie Sanders, you know, in a very, you know, Joe Roganish way, it's like, yeah, man, I think I'll probably vote for Bernie Sanders. He seems like a good guy. And the Sanders campaign, like, clipped like a, you know, 90-second, you know, video of him saying nice things about Bernie and tweeted it out. And there was all of this outrage about that, you know, that, you know, because he accepted the endorsement of this terrible person, Joe Rogan. And of course, lots of that was ginned up, you know, by bad faith actors, supporters of other candidates. But what bothered me is that I also saw lots of people with that, you know, Democratic Socialist Rose emoji and their Twitter handles. Yeah. Going along with this, oh no, that's really bad. Bernie should not have, you know, accepted, you know, the support of Joe Rogan. And, you know, it's not my purpose here to start any shit with specific people, so I'll leave names out. But, you know, I certainly saw people in left media, you know, saying the same thing at the time, and that really bothered me on a really basic level, because it seems like what do you think you're even doing, right? You know, what's the purpose of, you know, what do you think that, you know, that politics is? What do you think an election is? You know, because, you know, quite apart from, you know, from what you think about, you know, Joe Rogan, who I think is actually like tons of Americans are, and that, like, he has, you know, some kind of right-wing takes on some issues. He has some, you know, very left-wing takes on some issues. You know, he probably spends more time thinking about, you know, psychedelics and MMA and half a dozen other subjects, you know, than about this stuff. So it hasn't really, you know, doesn't necessarily all gel together.
And probably very similar to a lot of Americans, his probably most central position on politics is that the whole thing's corrupt.
Right.
Like this whole thing is just stinks. And I can tell that it's basically these politicians are bought and paid for. And this isn't actually a system that works for regular people.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So when you have somebody like that, you know, who could go in any number of different directions politically, supporting you, and it's not like this is after some process of negotiation where you had to like give up your positions on some issues to get his support, you know, you're just getting this for free. You'd think that you'd say, oh, thank God, this is great, right? You know, like at this, because not only do we have like the most popular podcaster in the world who has a massive audience of, you know, people who aren't necessarily super political, you know, who's saying, you know, who's supporting the campaign. So great, more people vote for us, which is, you know, the point of an election, right? To get more people to vote for you than the other guy. If you're not saying that, instead you're saying, no, this is really bad because, you know, Joe Rogan said the following list of bad things and had the following list of bad guests. So therefore you're like corrupted somehow by that support. That tells me that at that point, you're not really seeing left politics as a project to change the material world. you're seeing it as some kind of individual performance of moral commitment that, you know, you want to, you're just trying to prove to yourself or to other people that you're committed to all the right things and you're not really interested in actually achieving your alleged political goals.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like it's twofold. It's that point that you just made. And then it's also just what you alluded to earlier, that it's like, but don't you also see that you're becoming a useful idiot now? Like, don't you see that obviously if there's some Biden surrogate or these networks or these papers that are way behind Biden who are pushing this narrative, and if you're going along with it, then you're just working for them. Like, and this was my point to with the issue of the big banks. When you see Bank of America and JP Morgan Chase and all these guys jumping on the woke train, and you realize it's like, zoom back a little bit, okay? 10 years ago, which is not that long. In our contemporary world, it feels like forever, but it's not that long ago. At 10 years ago, the left were standing outside the big banks screaming, we are the 99%. And really, they might as well have been saying, we are the 99.9%, because they weren't talking about some guy making $300K a year. They were talking about the people who own hedge funds versus the rest of us. Like, a very clear contrast that a lot of Americans could get on board with. And this scared the bejesus, and rightfully so, out of all of these institutions. And if you go see that they are jumping on board after you scream, we are the 99%, and they're jumping on board with like, well, instead of 99%, let's focus on the 13% or the 2% or the 1% and pit all of you guys against each other, that obviously this is, you know, this is some type of, whether conscious or not, this is working in their favor to not focus on the very central issue that you guys were focused on just a decade ago. And it, to me, it seems like it's almost, you know, like when you said with Rogan, you're not even asking for a bargain. He's not even saying, oh, I want you to change this view. He's just saying, I think I'm going to support your guy. But I could understand in some theory making a bargain. Like, I think probably all of us would be willing to at some point make some bargain short of what our ideal society would be. You know, me and you might both think that Raytheon CEOs should have all of their wealth seized, for they've made it through building bombs and buying off congressmen and killing innocent children in the Middle East, you know. But we'd probably make a deal. You know, you guys could keep that money if we just stopped dropping bombs on kids. You know, like, we'd probably be willing to make a deal. I could understand making a deal with JP Morgan Chase, but the deal isn't even anything. It's like their deal is they'll send their execs to diversity training. It'd be one thing, right, if JP Morgan Chase was like, hey, look, you know, we're JP Morgan Chase. We have a little bit more influence than your average left winger over this government. So we are going to lobby really hard for criminal justice reform.
Yeah, right.
If you leave us alone about this other stuff, we'll do that. But they're not even offering you that. They're just offering you, like, how about we make a poster and we say, we put BLM outside one of our banks, and then we send our rich white executives who are going to keep all of their money to go some training, and they'll stand up and say, yes, yes, I'm racist because of the color of my skin and blah, 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 and then move on raping the entire country as they have been. How is that deal acceptable to the average left winger?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess to be fair, you know, for lots of, you know, for lots and lots of them, it's not, but it is, I think, you know, but I think that the thing that I do want some people to think more about, because I'm sure, like, lots of people who are doing things that I criticize in the book, you know, would nod along to what you just said, right? You know, it's like, sure, you know, that's, you know, that's obviously not good enough. You know, we still hate these people. But I think that the thing that I would hone in on about that is that it is just symbolic, right? So, like, it's not even like, okay, you know, they're going to put the float, you know, in the gay pride parade, but, you know, they're not like, you know, I'm sure that it would not come up with, you know, would not take a lot of creativity to come up with something they could do with all of their money that, you know, that would actually, like, you know, materially help, you know, like, I don't know, you know, gay teenagers who, you know, were kicked out of the house or something like that, right? You know, that, like, that there's some thing in the real world that they could do with that money that would actually help people. But, you know, but it's purely symbolic. And, you know, I think that sometimes people will say, you know, who you know, who disagree with some of the things I say in the book. Well, okay, but you know, sure, fair enough. I mean, obviously, we're not going to be bought off with that, you know. But you know, why not both, right? You know, we can have, like, we could fight the like stupid little symbolic battles, and also the more significant ones. And I'm not sure that you can actually do both. You know, I think that. I remember Freddie DeBoer had a good post about this in the Substack. I think it was just called "Perhaps You Can Actually Do Both." And in that, you know, he makes the point that there is like a limited budget of attention and resources, and you know, like all of that stuff, right, comes in somewhat limited quantities. And of course, if we're talking about stuff that actually, you know, matters, I mean, of course, you're right, you know, that there are, anytime you're actually engaged in real politics, you know, there are going to be trade-offs, you know, but at least, like, we can say, you know, whatever we might agree or disagree about which trade-offs we'd be willing to make under what circumstances, that if we're talking about, like, you know, anti-discrimination laws or something, all right, that matters. So, you know, but, like, if you're talking about pure symbolism, that really doesn't matter. And it's also worth thinking about what kinds of symbolism are even sending a message that's useful when it comes to winning over, you know, all the people that you'd have to win over to actually accomplish any of this stuff. Because what worries me is that oftentimes the symbol, you know, I mean, forget JP Morgan Chase for a minute, you know, like the symbolic message that, you know, even people that I like are sending is, we look at us being overgrown hall monitors who are very concerned with monitoring every aspect of each other's behavior all the time. And that's a message that's going to appeal to almost no one.
Yeah. I was going to read that quote from the book, but I want to ask you this first, because to the point you just made, and I've been saying this for a long time on the show, and this is a critique of the left and the right. It's a critique of our entire society. And I'll use free market libertarian language for this, but I think you would agree with what I'm saying. And what the way I've always said it is that, look, outrage is a finite resource.
Right.
That we only have so many hours in the day. We only have so much breath in our lungs. There is only so much you can be outraged about. And therefore, you need a hierarchy of values of what deserves the most outrage. And that's not right to say that there aren't lots of things, but, you know, if someone gets murdered on the street and then you stub your toe later, you really got to be more concerned about the person getting murdered, because right, otherwise you're first off wasting your time. And besides that, you're almost in being a useful idiot for helping the guy get away with murder, because you're focusing on all the wrong things. And to me, you know, like this manifests itself all over the place. And one of my criticisms of the left was that during the Trump years, I go, look, Donald Trump could drop a bomb on a third world country and kill 100 people, which he did plenty of. Mm-hmm. And then that same day, he could say something like, you know, I don't think trans should be in the military, or something right like that. And it's not like 2-1 the outrage goes to the transgender comment. It's like 100,000-1, right, if there's right even a one. Like, no right one's even thinking about it. And that is, now, again, it's like people get trapped in this kind of binary thinking, and they'll go like, so you don't care about the transgender comment? It's like, no, I'm not saying you don't have to care about that. I'm saying that the proportion of outrage to 100 real human beings, some of which might have been trans, were murdered that day. And by the way, they're all poor and not mm-hmm white and in third world countries, if that helps. Not that it would be okay if you were to do it to rich white people so the point is just that the outrage priorities seem all off. And there was this passage in the book that I literally wanted to stand up and applaud that you wrote it. I want to read this. And you were talking about this in the first chapter of the book, and you were talking about Louis C.K. And mm-hmm, I guess Louis C.K., who, his politics were always pretty moderate Democrat, like pretty much was going to support whoever the establishment Democrat candidate was. And he had sent some money to Joe Biden, and the Joe Biden team had returned the money and kind of been like, yeah, we don't want Louis C.K.'s money. And you wrote this, which I loved. You said, still, Whatever you may think of this tangle of ethical issues, the bottom line is that Louis C.K.'s sins involved masturbation. Joe Biden was one of the loudest voices on the Democratic side of the aisle calling for the invasion of Iraq in 2002 and 2003. Well over a million human beings died in that conflict. In a sane world, Louis C.K. would have been the one who would have worried about people associating him with Joe Biden.
Right.
I mean... That to me sums it all up perfectly. Where are our priorities of moral outrage when we find the sins of Louis C.K., whatever right. those may be, to be a more grave sins
yeah, right.
than getting a million people killed, well over a million at this point, in a yeah. in a war that everyone acknowledges never needed to be fought?
Yeah, right. And I mean, this is like, this is a big, and of course, you know, that's a big problem. And in that case, you know, that's a problem that's about, you know, liberals, you know, who are the ones who, you know, who are immediately, you know, being criticized, in that passage. And if I thought that like all of the ridiculous things that, you know, that liberals were doing, that there was like a, there was a sharp, like bright, unambiguous line, between, you know, between that and the way that people who actually agree with me politically are and the things that they're doing and how they're acting, then fair enough. I mean, I might have made that point in a Jacobin article somewhere, but you know, like that would be, I wouldn't have to write the book maybe, but I think in practice there really isn't, you know, like because in practice you have a left where there is like a lot of the sort of bad things about the way that contemporary liberalism is have, you know, kind of infiltrated in and colored the way that, you know, that people do things there too. Because I think that what you're talking about that kind of like limited budget of outrage, and the sort of, and the absurdities of this, like, I don't know. I mean, like when I see those clips, from the DSA convention in 2019, where people, you know, like you're told not to clap because it's possible that out of 600 people there might be three with some incredibly rare condition that makes them, you know, especially sensitive to loud noises, and then people are talking about that, and somebody gets up and says, oh, no crosstalk, you know, hey guys, no crosstalk, and a third person says, hey guys, is gendered language, you know, I think. And, you know, and I know that like those clips were famously put together by Tucker Carlson, who's a person I deeply hate, right? You know, like I, you know, but and you could say always cherry picking the worst moments, and he is.
Sure.
But also those moments are there for him to cherry pick. And it's not like some, you know, Breitbart thing with, you know, Planned Parenthood or whatever, where, you know, somebody's like coming in with a gabbra. This is stuff that they are streaming to the world. And it seems like nobody there is thinking about, or at least nobody there who wants to say anything. I'm sure lots of people are thinking it in their heads, right? You know, nobody there seems to be thinking about whether this is the image that you want to put out to yeah. the entire world, that like we've got enough left over in our outrage budget, you know, to like get upset about clapping and the phrase, hey guys, yes. like that just doesn't seem helpful.
Okay. So I will first off disclaim that I played that clip and made fun of it on the show as well, because it was just so hilarious and just ridiculous. But I really, here's where I can really relate to you, right? Like, okay. So I don't know if you've ever seen, but I get sent this clip all the time. I was just recently talking about it on my last podcast of the Libertarian convention in 2016. And the question is asked to the candidates, do you think there should be government driver's licenses? And they go down the list and every one of them are like, drive, what's next? A license to make toast in my own damn toaster? And he's, of course we should never have driver's licenses. And then Gary Johnson goes, I mean, I don't know. I guess maybe like before you start driving a car, you should have to get a license. And everyone's like, bah! Bo. And you sit there and you're like, look, man, and I think the same thing is happening in this democratic socialist conference that you're talking about. You get so into your little own world and so absorbed by the minutia and detail of what we think about in splitting hairs down to like 1/16th of the hair that you first had. And it's almost like zoom out and just understand, guys, we look like assholes right now to the rest of the world. This is insane. Like, if you can't see this, you are completely removed from what real regular people see when they look at this, which is that what you're talking about has nothing to do with any of their problems. It is not in any way and you would think, right, from the libertarian perspective, you're like, hey, guys, we're in the longest wars in American history.
Right.
There is a crisis facing the nation right now. The government is locking. I mean, this was 2016,
sure, so sure.
Other things, but all of the issues. I mean, if you're like a democratic socialist, you'd be like, guys, look at the amount of money the amount of billionaires on welfare right now. Like Americans, the American government hasn't rejected welfare. They're just giving it to billionaires. You know what I mean? Like there's so many real important points that actually speak to the working class that you're trying to reach that it's like, what do you think the average, you know, you're the democratic socialist. You're here to stand for the working class. What do you think the average working Joe thinks when he looks at you and hears this, excuse me, point of personal privilege, he, him, and the audible noise? Do you think you are relating to the average trucker right now in America? And it seems to me that, and this is true in the libertarian world too. You wrote, this is another quote from the book that I really loved. You said, I certainly don't claim to have all the answers, but I'm pretty certain that making ourselves look like overgrown hall monitors is unhelpful. And I just thought this is because I'll tell you, there's a lot of the woke stuff has come into the libertarian world as well. And you just go for you're like, guys, this appeals to a very narrow slice of the American population. Forget not even arguing over the absurdity of it, because frankly, I find the idea absurd. That you shouldn't clap because someone might have PTSD. Right. Like, this is just ridiculous. I also, you know, maybe I'll get in trouble for this. I find the idea of using your gender pronouns a little bit ridiculous too. For the people who that applies to, maybe it makes sense. You don't have to agree with me on this. I don't want to get you in trouble, but I just don't think like your regular man or regular woman needs to waste their time letting everyone know that I am what you already know I am. But regardless of that, just on the practical level, you look like assholes now to the vast majority of the population who you're trying to win over to your side. And so if you want to, this is always my message to libertarians, and I think it's a good message for democratic socialists as well. Focus on the real crises that are affecting real people's lives right now. That's a message that could really resonate with people. And in fact, look, whatever you have to say with him, this is why Bernie Sanders rose up to prominence. This is why this old curmudgeon-y guy who wasn't doing it off sex appeal or naked charisma, he rose up to prominence because he was like, hey, I want to give Americans health care. Like, hey, you know, like that's what actually that your average working person, you know, right now is like, yeah, my premiums are like way too high. And I got this huge deductible and a copay. You know, like this sucks. That actually speaks to me. You know, anyway.
Yeah, so I'd say like that. Actually, you know, I think it's interesting on the pronoun thing. So there's Natalie Wynn is a very prominent left wing YouTuber. ContraPoints is the channel, and you know, she's a trans woman, and she got. One of the things she got in trouble for on Twitter a couple of years ago was saying that she always feels ridiculous. You know, like there seems like something very strange about the fact that she can sit at a sports bar in North Carolina and be miss and mammed all night, you know, with no problem. And then she goes to like a lefty meeting and everybody's going around saying their pronouns and she can sort of feel everybody pivoting and staring, you know, like when it's her turn. And, you know, I understand like different, you know, different people have, like different feelings about that for different reasons. I mean, I think a practical solution is just like, you know, give people name tags if they want to write their pronouns down on it, they can, but you know, you don't have to make a big thing about it. But I think that on, you know, on the other, you know, the other issue that you're talking about, that's like, I know, cause I, you know, spend way too much time like, at this point, like, I've internalized, like, all the shit that people who, you know, who are going to, like, have their hackles up about this are going to say in response to what you just said. And so I can hear that little voice in my head saying, oh, you know, so you're just, like, talking about some stereotypical, you know, Leave It to Beaver, you know, like, white male, you know, worker in a, you know, in a hard hat, you know, like, that's the guy you're talking about not appealing to. But I think that, no, like, I mean, sure, that guy too, right? Yeah. You know, but like, not just him. I think that any normal human being, where by normal human being, that's not like a dog whistle for, yeah, you know, white male, cis, whatever, right? Like, I just mean like anybody who's not marinating in the particular political subculture of the left, you know, so whether we're talking about like, you know, Black, trans, Wiccans, anybody, right? You know, like who is, doesn't just swim in this world, you know, when they see that, that no clapping clip, they say, oh, wow, those seem like some like really unpleasant weirdos. I don't want to have anything to do with that.
And that they in no way represent the working class. And yeah, no, I'm not talking about the white working class. I'm talking about the Black working class, the Latino working class. I'm talking about regular working class people in America. None. And this is something that I think is, again, I think this is true for libertarians as well, because oftentimes libertarians are, both of us from our own conception of what freedom is, are fighting for regular people's freedom. But you know, you have this almost like this disconnect between the kind of academic world that has all of these ideas in their head, and then the real world, the people who are actually out there in the working class. And the cultures are quite different. Right. And when you're coming off with this thing, like, it's just a cultural difference where it's like, yeah, most people, you know, I remember when Andrea Mitchell, God, I'm trying to remember what she said. She was talking about the Kamala Harris, Mike Pence VP debate. And she said, every man who I've talked to has said that he was mansplaining to her and that this is just something that's really not going to appeal to men. And it's like, no, this is a comment, Andrea Mitchell, on the men you hang out with. This isn't a comment on men or women, for that matter, or for working class women who have never used the word mansplain a day in their life. Like, this is what you and Alan Greenspan at cocktail parties run into. And it's, there's something really ironic about the fact that democratic socialists who at their core are supposed to be challenging that class and fighting for the working class, right? But yet they've absorbed a lot of these values, which, listen, you just, I'm sorry, you just don't go into, well, if you go into a working class environment, you don't see concern for microaggressions. That is something that you find at universities. That is an elitist value, because there are so many more real concerns in the working class's mind that no one's going, hey, he said, where are you from? And, you know, I'm actually not from here. And that's offensive to me, because, but like, they're just not concerned with this stuff. And you're never, you know, you're never going to relate to that class, let alone be their champions, when you have these values that are like completely counter to everything they are.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. So you can't, I think a big part of the problem is that in practice, you know, most people on the left come out like of, are like, part of the reason why, you know, leftism appeals to them is because they're, you know, they're downwardly mobile, because, you know, they like, you know, because increasingly a lot of people who are, you know, even are like educated professionals, you know, like have, you know, more precarious, you know, financial circumstances, you know, like the, an obvious example would be like how many people who, you know, teach at colleges compared to 10 years ago or adjuncts, you know, who might not even necessarily have health insurance now. And, you know, my point in saying this is not to say like, oh, you know, screw those guys, right? You know, like, we, you know, I don't, you know, I don't want them, right? You know, like, I mean, for one thing, obviously, you know, like, you know, obviously I also, you know, come out of that, you know, but the problem is when so many leftists, so many democratic socialists are either sort of downwardly mobile members of, you know, the professional classes, or are at the very least the downwardly mobile sons and daughters, you know, of the professional classes. That means that they're acculturated to all of this stuff that is, you know, might sometimes, you know, be good in certain ways, or, you know, or to a certain extent, you know, like that. That's I think that, you know, that there are things that maybe some of the stuff prevents that, you know, that should be prevented. But you do have to chill out on all of it at a certain point if you're going to reach out to or be appealing to, you know, like anybody who comes from outside of that, you know, because at the end of the day, if you sound less like someone that the people you're trying to appeal to would want to hang out with, then you sound like somebody who the people you're trying to appeal to might have to deal with because, you know, they're sent from the HR department, you know, then like they're just not going to want to have anything to do with you.
Yeah, which is just kind of a basic life lesson in some ways, not even just applicable to politics. But if trying to persuade someone of anything in life, step one is usually being someone who they'd want to be persuaded by. Right. Like, you know, if you're not, that's usually going to make your job that much harder. So that's just a good life lesson in general. So one of the things that you talk about in the book, you have a chapter on the genealogy of left-wing moralism. And I find all of this stuff really interesting. And I think that right at the heart of one of your critiques is the idea that there's a lot of this moral outrage and condemnation of regular people seems to be at odds with what the spirit of leftism was supposed to be all about. And particularly to the point that we were making before, especially when it's you know, the target is at regular people. And again, I know we keep using this term regular people, but all I mean by that is the Occupy Wall Street, you know, sense, the 99%, like not the guy who owns a hedge fund, the guy. Yeah, right. I mean, there was this one case that got a lot of attention where this woman was fired for posting on her Facebook, "All Lives Matter." Mm-hmm. And like you can feel however you do about saying "all lives matter," and certainly there's more than just the statement "all lives matter" statement. It's a counter to "Black Lives Matter," and there's and you can feel however you feel about it, but you're like, this was just some lady, what I mean? Like, I don't know. Right. Maybe she was a jerk, or maybe she just meant it. Like "all lives matter" could be meant in not the way that you're offended by.
I think it probably was, you know, I mean, in practice, realistically, right. You know, somebody says "all lives matter," they're making a statement of opposition to BLM. I do think, I mean, you know, I think as somebody who very much supports, you know, the goals of BLM, I think that having like a, I think people have never had like a good, like the way that plays out, right? You know, when people will say like, "Oh, all lives matter," and then like the response is to get infuriated about that, you know, like I think it's just like kind of rhetorically tone deaf that, you know, you could say I don't think it should be that hard to just say, yes, all lives matter. That's why Black Lives Matter, right? You know, that should be an easy play. But I think the more basic question there is, should we want people to be fired from their jobs for just saying like kind of, you know, like bog standard, you know, right-wing things, you know, that like surely at least, you know, at the very least, like, you know, 70 million people, you know, voted for Donald Trump in the last election. And that's like stuff that like anybody, you know, that like any of them, you know, would say. And I think no, right. You know, both cause I want everybody to have like a, be able to make a good living, and, you know, and even that includes people that I disagree with politically. But also it's like a terrible strategy because like, what's like, how do you imagine this playing out? You know, is somebody going to say It's like, oh yeah, those people who ruined my life, you know, who got me, you know, got me fired from my job, you know, because they won, they defeated me in this way, you know, like, I guess now I agree with them, you know, like, yeah. that just seems like the most unlikely way that could possibly play out.
And it just seems, at least in my lifetime, and I feel like there's been like a real shift in how militant this stuff has gotten. And again, this isn't everybody on the left. Obviously, you just wrote a book about this, and there's lots of people, I think a lot more who agree, who don't want to speak up because there mm-hmm. is such militancy against them. They're like, oh, I don't want to be the next one who's getting crucified here. But to me, you know, at least as a kid, I always felt like the spirit of the left was kind of like, okay, there might be somebody who like stabbed someone when they were 18, but you know, they had a really bad life and a really bad childhood. And they went to jail for 10 years and, you know, they've paid their debt to society and look at all the good things they did while they were in jail. And we are ready to try to bring that person back into the fold. And yet now you have this thing where it's like, wouldn't your impulse be if someone says all lives matter to be like, hey, let me explain to you why that kind of bugs us when you say all lives matter. Cause it's kind of like, we're trying to talk about that. You know what I mean? And it's just like, you just want some regular lady publicly humiliated and then fired. And that, that's pretty creepy.
Yeah, no, exactly. That is like an obvious, like bizarre, contradiction, you know, like when I like even, this is not like a, you know, this is not a regular person, you know, in that sense that we've been talking about, you know, so I don't know if you're following what happened a few weeks ago, whenever this was at Teen Vogue, where which is like as funny as this sentence sounds, like, you know, like Teen Vogue has been publishing all of this like super duper lefty stuff in the last little while, like to the point where there'll be like there'll be articles and, you know, in Teen Vogue, like, you know, like, you know, 10 things you probably didn't know about Karl Marx. Like, right. Okay. but they hired somebody to be the new editor of Teen Vogue, who had tweeted apparently 10 years before as a teenager. She had tweeted some sort of edgelordy kind of mildly racist things. And again, this happened a decade ago when she was a teenager. And all I could think is like, how many people who are like, who want this person to be fired, and I think she eventually just resigned under pressure, are like prison abolitionists, right? You know, like, and certainly, cause like, you know, this, the spectrum on the far left on that issue goes from just outright abolitionism about police and prisons to like, okay, maybe we can't quite do that, but like, let's at least have like, you know, vastly more humane and rehabilitative, you know, prisons. And certainly everybody, you know, on the left supports like, you know, ban the box. So, you know, you can't be denied, you know, employment, you know, after you get out of prison, you know, because of your prison record. So at a certain point, it's like, so somebody who is in prison for rape, who gets out, right, should be forgiven and allowed to get a new job. And somebody who had bad tweets 10 years ago, like this can just be held against them for all eternity, you know, or like the, I think one of the worst examples, you know, that I think about a lot is, you know, Cenk Uygur, who is, you know, whatever people, you know, people think about Cenk or his politics or, you know, any of the controversies about him, and, you know, his politics are not exactly my politics, but he has, this came up again this last year, because, he was briefly running for Congress, and it was used against him there. And it came up like a year or two ago, cause the Justice Democrats, which is an organization like that helped elect AOC, et cetera, that he helped found, you know, as one of the main leaders of, that he was forced out of that because of this. And this is that like literally 15 years ago, 20 years ago, something like that. When he was a young Republican, he had written some blog posts. It was long enough ago that we still had blogs. And in the blog posts, you know, he, you know, as look, in my, you know, in my view, you know, conservatives tend to believe lots of stupid shit. And, you know, and he said lots of stupid shit in these blog posts and, you know, some things I would find pretty objectionable. But like, also, this was decades ago. And in those decades, like for most of that time, he had completely come over politically, and he, you know, was an extremely progressive person. And so the message that you're sending when you keep dredging this stuff up to use against him is, hey, if you currently disagree with us, if we persuade you, if you come over, you're on our side now, we reserve the right anytime we get mad at you to like use against you the fact that once you disagreed with us, it's like, wow, that is a hell of a recruiting pitch. I mean, who wouldn't, you know, who wouldn't want to come over after that?
Well, there's a couple things, right, that come to my mind about that. And by the way, your boy Bernie disavowed him after that. Probably never made it all the way up to Bernie Sanders. Probably a decision on his campaign team or something like that. But I did think it was a bad decision. And particularly because Cenk had apologized for these things, like over the course of years and been
so
like,
many
yeah,
times,
was,
so
like, this
ago.
Was stupid. I was young. You know, I shouldn't have written that. You know, what? It's just, again, I just think a non-issue. But it reminds me of your great quote that I read earlier. And applying that to this, so that Bernie Sanders is now in the position of disavowing this guy's support because he wrote some questionable things a couple decades ago. Meanwhile, Joe Biden's up there like, yeah, I voted for the war in Iraq and championed it, but you know, I've changed my mind since then. It's like, oh, okay, so your apology, an apology covers a million dead people, but an apology doesn't cover like I wrote some quasi-sexist things in a blog a couple decades ago, right? Like that. So that there's just a real problem there. All right, guys, let's take a quick second and thank our sponsor for today's show, which is YoKratom.com, the world's best value in kratom, $60 for a kilo, shipped right to your door, no questions asked. Now, if you're not a fan of kratom or you've never heard of kratom before, just ignore this ad. We're not talking to you. No need to hear this and go try kratom. But if you're currently a fan of kratom, then go celebrate your freedom at YoKratom.com, home of the $60 kilo, which is unheard of. YoKratom is one of the biggest sellers of Kratom nationwide, and they made YoKratom so you can buy directly at wholesale prices. This is quality Kratom. We've heard great feedback from the fans. They confirm it's solid. And like I said, it's the only place where you can get a kilo for $60. So last time, if you're currently a fan of Kratom, go to YoKratom.com and get yourself a $60 kilo. All right, let's get back on the show. One of the other things I would say, right, if I were giving my own amateur strategic advice to Democratic Socialists, not that I want you guys to succeed, but, you know, but I would say that there are a lot of people, right? Look, I can tell you just my perspective right now. I'm a unique situation that I'm a hardcore free market anarchist type. But, like, the healthcare prices that I pay for me and my wife and my daughter are outrageous. I mean, just like outrageous. And then we have deductibles and copays. And then if you have to go to the emergency room for something, you're still stuck with a bill. You know, it's just like, this is bonkers. And there's a lot of people, I think, out there who this is part of the reason more people who traditionally wouldn't have necessarily supported someone like Bernie Sanders, but they see the costs of their kids' college and the cost of their healthcare and the cost of all these other things. And you're like, you know what? I mean, at least this guy's telling me he's got a plan to deal with some of this. But part of the reason why socialism gets demonized, right, is because of the history of the authoritarian socialist regimes. And I know that you've talked about this a lot, not just in this book, but throughout your career. And this is a big thing that the Democratic Socialists have to try to contend with and explain that, listen, we are a different strand of socialism. We are not we are not here to offer this authoritarian crackdown on dissident views. We are here to talk about power imbalances, an economic system that works more for the average person. And when they see this stuff, even when people don't really have the power in the political apparatus, but when they see the spirit of already being that we want to crush dissident thinkers, this is going to convince a lot of people, and I think fairly, that, my God, I mean, the type of people who want to go back in your tweets from 15 years ago and ruin your life over that, I pray to God they never hold political power.
Yeah, right.
You know, and I'm sure you do too. So that's another thing to think about, not just in the fact that it makes it harder to recruit, but also the fact that all of us you and other democratic socialists included, you don't want to see these type of people hold power. Lord knows what they would do with it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that, of course, to a large extent, you know, people who act like this do hold power because in the society that we're, you know, that we're currently living in, I mean, some of the worst offenders for these kinds of behavior are like, you know, centrist Democrats, and in fact, there are many, you know, famous cases, or I don't know, maybe not as famous as they should be, you know, where it's been effectively used against the left. So, like an example of that would be Ben Mora, who was a Bernie staffer, and another place like the Jake case, where I think the Bernie campaign folded when it shouldn't have, who had like a private Twitter account, and you know, and Ben Mora is like a you know, he's a gay guy whose sense of humor, you know, has, you know, like, you know, a lot of comments about people's appearances, you know, that you know, you get a picture, right? You know, that's had and he'd say some pretty nasty stuff, right? This was also a private follower only Twitter account, and somebody sent a bunch of screenshots from it to the Daily Beast. And then this Daily Beast reporter didn't do what I would hope that any, like, you know, vaguely responsible adult journalist would have done, and be like, this isn't news. What's wrong with you? Yeah. And they published it and, you know, got him fired and everything. And I think that kind of thing happens a lot. And I should say, by the way, that I think that this sort of, like this way of doing things, this kind of like, you know, Twitter pile-ons, all that stuff, like in the book, I'm very concerned with the way that it intersects with the specific pathologies of the left, because I'm concerned with what that does to the left and how it, you know, how it makes us less effective and all that stuff. But I do think it's a much bigger problem, you know, that infects, you know, society as a whole for a lot of reasons we could get into. You know, that there are, you know, and there are certainly examples of this sort of thing, you know, going on the right. So if you read, like, John Ronson has a book from 2015 called So You're Being Publicly Shamed, where he doesn't have, like, the phrase, I think it was, like, a little bit too early for the phrase, like, call out culture, never mind, like, cancel culture, which is what seems to have replaced it. But that's what he's describing. And one of the examples in his book is this girl, Lindsay Stone, who was just, like, not a public figure in any sense, just a normal person. She had a job. She worked for this organization, Life, that works with adults with learning disabilities. By all accounts, she was very good at her job. You know, the clients loved her, the parents loved her. And while she and her friend Jamie, who also worked there, while they're on their office hours, they like to take, like, jokey pictures of each other and post them to Facebook. And so, like, there'd be one where one of them is, you know, smoking a cigarette in front of a no smoking sign, stuff like that. And one of them, they were on a field trip, you know, for this organization in Washington, D.C., and on their off hours, they're at Arlington National Cemetery, and there's the sign there that says silence and respect. And so Jamie took a picture of Lindsay going, like, right, pretending like she's yelling something next to silence and the silence respect sign, and posted that to her. Or Facebook, where, you know, it's like 20 people would see it or whatever. And I guess, like a lot of people, she wasn't great about the privacy settings, you know, so it was accidentally set to public. And this ended up being this giant thing where there were people who were, there was like a Fire Lindsay Stone Facebook group with like 10,000 people in it. And she did end up getting fired because it just sort of randomly went viral. And, you know, people were talking about how she's a, you know, fat feminist who should go to hell and, you know, shouldn't be allowed in the United States, you know? So I think, like, all of the reasons why this stuff happens, which are that it's, that we live in a society where people are pretty atomized and they often feel most connected to other people online.
Yeah.
the social media platforms themselves, they're, you know, for-profit businesses, and they try to make it as addictive as at all possible, and it really incentivizes a lot of bad behavior. I would argue the fact that most people live in work in non-unionized workplaces where, you know, the idea that somebody could whisper something in someone's ear and they could get fired, you know, like is a real fear for a lot of people. Like all of these things like end up impacting, you know, the whole political spectrum, you know, that like people act this way all over the place. I think a lot of times it has a kind of woke flavor, you know, because that's the, you know, because that's what's going on in the culture, you know, at the time. But I also think it's a much bigger problem. And that, you know, but yeah, also though, I do take your point that it's that if you want to give people the impression that you're not some kind of wannabe authoritarian, then even if lots of other people act that way too, you know, you certainly shouldn't act like you're some sort of like weird toy inquisitor.
Yeah. So one of the things, and I make this point a lot on the show when I talk about this stuff, because it's very easy for right wingers now to rail against cancel culture and be like, this is so authoritarian and so messed up, and kind of say a lot of the things that we're saying here because they don't like this left-wing culture. Sure. But I make the point all the time that the last time in America that I believe we had what you could truly call a right-wing culture, where the right-wingers were really in charge of the institutions and the temperature, was right after 9/11.
Right.
And they were quite happy to cancel people in that time too. And at that time, it was for more right-wing reasons. You know, you questioned the troops or
the Dixie Chicks.
Right. Not for being called Dixie Chicks, but for questioning the troops.
That's true. That's like a good indication of how much the culture has changed.
Yes, that's right. About
the Dixie Chicks. Nobody ever once brought up that they were called the Dixie Chicks.
Right. But it was a different.
They made mildly anti-Bush comments.
But here's the thing. That's interesting, right? And this is what I really want people to see through is that it's all the same corporate interests that were pushing that cancel culture and are pushing this one. The corporate press, right, who will now be, you know, up in arms about whatever the latest woke violation is about Bernie Sanders or whatever, they were selling George W. Bush's wars. All of the, like, this whole corporate apparatus jumped from that to this. Now, a lot of people will say, and me and you messaged about this just the other day, but I was trying to like get this point across that it's like a lot of people will look at what happens on the left and the rise of this kind of woke cancel culture and the kind of Jordan Peterson, Ben Shapiro, a lot of people who rose up from smacking it down, you know, battling these college kids with their crazy woke ideology, which for a lot of us was very satisfying to see when it first came up because you felt like someone needed to kind of, you know, argue with some of these kids. But their thing more or less, and I think Dave Rubin and other people have this take where they're like, look, the left overtook the liberals. And there's this sense that almost seems kind of plausible on the surface because you can look at it and you can say, well, look at all these supposed liberal values like, you know, free speech and yada, yada, and they don't really have them. And a lot of these ideas do have their origins in, you know, critical race theory, in postmodernists or other strands of left wing thought. Right. So there is a plausibility on the surface to that. But if you kind of look at the bigger picture and realize that all of the corporate interests who were behind the liberals all these times that the leftists were fighting against have seized on this left-wing ideology and are pushing it like to 11, and you realize that you're like, well, actually, this is really the liberals overtaking the left. Because all of the critiques of corporate power seem to somehow go away. Like, they seem to be the ones, all these other critiques about society are put into the forefront. And the thing that you're just supposed to forget about, and now you'll even see these liberals, like on MSNBC or whatever, you know, supposed progressives, who will be up there, and when they describe cancel culture. They'll go, well, this is just being good corporate citizens because they're not just caring about the profit. You know, see, they have this higher calling of what really wanting to make society better. And when you start to see this being used as a reason for why corporations are actually making society better and not just concerned about the profit, you go, is this really the left overtaking the liberals? Because it looks a lot more to me like the liberals have weaponized a leftist term. And I would just, and I want to get your thoughts on this, but I would just say this is the other thing that I've talked about a lot on my show, is that Murray Rothbard had an analysis of the progressive era that I think was really interesting and on point. And of course, Murray Rothbard, when he does history, it's there's an agenda there as well. And there is, in the same sense of like Howard Zinn or somebody like that, or Noam Chomsky when he talks about history, you know what their agenda is. But he makes the point that during the progressive era, there were a lot of progressive intellectuals who pushed progressive policies because they wanted to rein in the robber barons, and they wanted life to be, you know, life to be better for the working class and kind of bleed the rich and these kind of, you know, socialistic impulses. But by the end of the progressive era, the robber barons had basically taken complete control of the managed economy. And they were like, oh, okay, we'll have a Federal Reserve, but guess who's going to be running the Federal Reserve? And guess who's going to be? And I would say that leftists should at least be aware of the fear of a corporate hijacking of what was your cause, because that to me seems to be pretty transparently what's going on here. However you feel about critical race theory, I'm not a fan personally. I actually find other, you know, left-wing schools of thought to be far more compelling. But regardless, you could be completely on board with it and still recognize that like all these big corporations jumping on board with it are not doing it for the same reasons that the left-wingers were initially supporting some of these ideas for.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that that as far as like left-wing origins of some of these ideas, I mean, I think that like a lot of times the like the version of the history of ideas that you get from your, you know, you mentioned Jordan Peterson and Dave Rubin, you know, like I would, well, I guess, let me just say, I would at the very least, I'd have a lot of problems, you know, with that version of the history. I think that if you look at, you know, like somebody like Peterson will say things like, oh, you know, basically he thinks that like postmodernism is like Marxism in disguise. And I'd say, well, like, look at the actual original postmodernists, these people like Foucault and Derrida, and, you know, and what they actually had to say about all of that, right? Like they were very like, part of their big thing was being against like sort of big sweeping theories of history and, you know, overall explanations of everything. And Marxism is actually exactly the kind of thing they had in mind, you know, like somebody like Sartre, who actually was a Marxist, like he and Foucault hated each other. And then also I would question how much on the other end of the equation, right? Like how much sort of postmodernism really has to do with like what some college activist is like.
Oh, you know? Yeah. No, I completely agree with you on that. And also the I mean, right, obviously like Marxism kind of relied on objective truth and objective reality. Right. And that's completely at odds with postmodernism. I also think that like, you know, to me, honestly, the Frankfurt School ideology, you can draw a closer line.
No,
to.
That one actually does come out of Marxism. Although I'd say that, you know, even though those are people who are very firmly in that intellectual tradition, that a lot of like the sort of, you know, Frankfurt School and the Frankfurt School becoming critical theory, a lot of that story is about them sort of giving up on the sort of political, you know, goals that they had and getting more and more interested in culture. And, you know, and so there's lots of things that you could be very, you know, very critical about from a Marxist, you know, perspective about that.
Sure.
But I do agree, I think, with your bigger point, which is that, you know, the idea, and, you know, when it comes to like your, you know, Jordan Peterson types and like the kind of like particular kinds of like stuff going on college campuses that, you know, that they're reacting to, you know, like I find the whole thing, you know, found the whole thing really frustrating on many levels. Like I think that, you know, because I have, you know, extremely little sympathy for those guys, but I also think that there were, the book you can see behind me, Against the Web by Michael Brooks, you know, he has a big thing about this where, you know, like, okay, I don't really like, you know, what Brett Weinstein has to say, you know, like I have, you know, I think a lot of it's kind of ridiculous. But I also think that, like, the only reason any of us know who this guy is, the only reason he has a public career is because student activists at, you know, at Evergreen College, you know, were reacting to him, you know, the way that they were. Like, if they just ignored him, right, we would never have to hear from this guy ever again, right? You know, and this is not like an isolated case. You know, like there are like I think it's a little bit different in its origins because, like, Evergreen, that actually is, like, you know, pretty misguided, like, grassroots activism, yeah. Whereas this one is much more of a corporate media thing. But I mean, it's like the same thing with, like, that kid, you know, Nicholas Sandman, however you say mm-hmm. that, who, like, he spoke at the Republican convention, like, and the only reason that we, you know, that we have to hear for this kid and his stupid opinions are that everybody went after him basically for wearing a Trump hat and, like, having what kind of looked at a still image, like a smug expression on his face. Yeah. That's it. Right. Yeah. That's the sum total of what he did. And I think that there's like a more general, like, thing that you can learn from a lot of these things, which is that this kind of, like, you know, moralistic anger, you know, at figures like this, is like the worst. It's like the it's like fucking Star Wars, you know, strike me down now and, you know, I'll be more powerful than you could possibly yeah. imagine, right? You know, but, like, yeah. this feeds into them like nothing else, you know, like nothing else possibly could. And, you know, and I think it's just stupid. It's an own goal, right? You yeah. know, that, like, you're doing this, you know, to yourself if you keep on, like, making a big deal of these figures and, you know, having, like, and responding to them by, you know, by trying to deplatform them, that, like, all that does is just, like, make them a right-wing celebrity, which of course it would, right? Cause like, part of the problem with this stuff is that, like, okay, one issue is whether free speech is valuable in itself, which I think it is, and, you know, and whether it should be a big part of, you know, any socialist society that's worth wanting, and I think it is. But, like, also, even if you disagreed with all that, in practice, in 2021, if you're any kind of leftist, like, we don't hold power. And so this idea that you can just make the bad people go away, like, is just doesn't make sense, because, like, you know, the biggest megaphones are in the hands of various people that we don't like. So it's not going to work out the way that you think it would. So that I know that was, that whole rant was a little bit of a, you know, of a digression.
But I thought it was very good.
I guess I do agree about the point about liberalism, you know, because I think that oftentimes in practice, right, because, like, what's supposed to be the big fundamental distinction between, you know, between liberalism and leftism, you know, well, but, you know, the big distinction is, do you think that the system is bad, or do you think that, like, it's just maybe being, like, administered by bad people, or that, yeah. like, it's, you know, needs to be, you know, you need to nibble a little bit around the edges to make it work. And if you think, oh, it's just being administered by bad people, you just need to nibble a little bit around the edges to make it work, then I can understand the sort of like fixation on individual morality that, like, you know, that like once we just get like good people, you know, in positions of prominence, or, you know, maybe a sufficiently diverse cast of good people, you know, that the system will be fine. But if you think that the system itself is the problem, then all of the focus on symbolism, on individual, you know, moral character, you know, which is what a lot of this stuff gets down to when you're obsessed with, you know, with whether somebody has, you know, bad tweets or, you know, bad takes, or, you know, like when people, like earlier in the interview, you mentioned, you know, Glenn Greenwald, and, you know, like I'll never understand how some people who think, you know, who think that they're socialists, care more about what shows he goes on or who he's feuding with.
Or even understand that the like, you know, all of these guys, like, who were all, I think, really good left-wing journalists, whether it's Glenn Greenwald or Aaron Matei or, you know, whoever else it might be, Jeremy Scahill or like some of these guys. But half the reason they go on these shows is because they're basically blacklisted from supposedly progressive networks. I mean, I'm sure Aaron Matei or Glenn Greenwald would have been happy to go on MSNBC and explain to them how they were just spewing CIA propaganda about Donald Trump being a Russian agent for 3 years, but they didn't seem interested to do that. And to your point, the distinction between the liberals and the leftists, well, you'd think that the like really at the heart of the left-wing ideology was always a preference for egalitarianism and a critique of big business and a critique of power imbalances and therefore a critique of imperialism. And so, you know, the left is supposed to have an allergy, a very important allergy to big business and to imperialism. And so if you see that, and those two things are related, of course, as me and you both know, that there are big business interests that are very, in bed with the imperial forces. And so it's just like when you see something like the CIA coming out and giving you talking points, and then, of course, all of these weapons companies getting extremely rich off of all of this stuff, it's just like, you know, that's all I would say, like my message to the left, just pay attention to where the imperialist forces and where the big corporate interests are putting their attention. And at least your default position should be suspicion of those forces. Whereas the liberals are, of course, going to love all of those forces because they really are. That's what they support.
Yeah. And again, you know, when it comes to someone like Greenwald, like I think like how people react to him is a really interesting bellwether of this, because, you know, none of his, like, you know, nobody has ever, like, all the arguing I've ever done with anybody about Glenn Greenwald, nobody has ever been able to point to like, okay, here's like a right wing thing that he thinks, right? Like that's not, like, never, right? Like they have, I mean, we're talking about like a gay Jewish left wing investigative journalism who lives in Brazil with his husband, who's a socialist congressman.
Right.
And so a lot of people have gotten into their heads that he's like secretly a Nazi or something is beyond me. But like also like, OK, look, let's say, you know, you think that he, you know, shouldn't go on these shows or whatever, which, as you say, a lot of that's because, you know, this NBC, which he actually used to go on all the time, you know, blackballed him. But like, just if that sort of thing matters to you, you know, more that like, oh, he went on the wrong show, or I don't like some of his takes on Twitter, or I don't, you know, like I think, you know, I think he was in the wrong about this like interpersonal thing or whatever. Like if that stuff like really gets you hot and bothered, and you're not like, and you care more about, I mean, like, even if we're in the, like, is Glenn Greenwald a good person or a bad person business, which I don't think should be the focus anyway, right? But, right. like, you know, even if we are in that business, like, if you care more about that than you do about exposing the NSA spying about, you know, on everybody, or exposing, you know, what was going on with the persecution of Lula in Brazil, then that starts to tell me that what you're doing is really something different from politics as I understand it, because you're not actually concerned with changing the world in any big picture sense and material reality. You know, what you're really concerned with is signaling that you have all the right, you know, commitments, and that, you know, and that you have the right reactions to things, and you have all the right tribal loyalties, which does nothing for anybody. It doesn't give anybody healthcare. It doesn't stop any wars. It doesn't, you know, unionize any workplaces, you know, like all it does maybe is make you feel better.
Right. And in addition to that, I would just say, and we do, I got to wrap on this because I got another show coming up, but I would also just say that if you are ever going to really be a threat to power, if you're ever going to really be a threat to the establishment, which is what leftists want to do, right, by their nature.
Right.
Then you're not going to be able to social signal and have everybody agree that you have the approved opinion. So, you know, that whole mentality and the type of person who needs to do that, you're never going to be successful at actually rolling back entrenched power, because, of course, the powerful have a lot of outlets and they're going to be critical of those type of people. So I do have to wrap, but I can't stress enough. I thought the book was fantastic. I thank you for writing it. Canceling Comedians While the World Burns, by Ben Burgess. Also, your podcast, Give Them an Argument. Is there anything else that you'd like to plug?
I mean, I think if you just go benburgess.com, that's the easiest, you know, one-stop shop to find links for everything. So yeah, thank you so much for having me on, brother.
Absolutely, my brother. It was a pleasure. Hope to do it again real soon. Thank you to everybody for watching or listening, and hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. All right, peace.